Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 24th, 2001. In the Creekside room is Mike Scott. Today's session number is SCMI 2001-04, and it's titled Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. Let's listen in.
How many of you, this is your first session with me this week? All right, good. So the rest of you, just some intro to what Earth Ministry is about and what our week's been about. If you do want to find out more about Earth Ministry, there's a table back there with mailing lists and brochures and mini journals and so on. A significant part of our work at Earth Ministry is to help provide the theology and worldview behind, let's say, a movement for living in greater balance with the rest of creation, and plumbing the depths of Christianity, both scripturally and in the tradition of the saints and so on, to see what is there. And of course, as you all know, we don't have to like reinvent something. It's more a matter of reclaiming something that's things that are already there. And then we help, how would that be expressed in everyday life as people of faith? How would we live in such a way that would express that belief, that faith, our values? And tonight we'll look at the abundant life and the good life a bit. And again, feel free to chime in at times if you have something you want to throw out there or interrupt me. And there'll be time for just interaction and discussion throughout, but especially toward the end. Welcome, guys. Let's see. So to begin, though, I wanted to, I can't see everybody. I'm sorry about this format. I should have gone first for a circle all week, but now stand up so I can see people. The first session on Monday was called Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, and it partly served as an introduction to this book, which is a collection of a myriad of issues that seems to me that simpler living involves and is prophetic to. And so, for example, this book goes, and there are copies in the bookstore, although I think they might be sold out, but they'll be getting more in. And you can pick up something in the back that would give you an 800 number to call if you wanted to order a copy of this book. But it has a lot of stuff in it, like time, our relationship with time, our relationship with money, ecological, eco-justice issues, economic justice issues, global lifestyle, global economics and connection to lifestyle, worldview and theology, simplicity in the Christian tradition, food choices. So there's a lot of stuff in there. Dan's enjoying dinner. Choosing his food carefully. Dan just thought, so it's pretty impressive he's even here. Would you mind saying a few words right now to help the man? And so when I went to, well, first of all, the forward to the book proved serves as, I think, a really beautiful meditation in a sense. So I want to start tonight with reading that part of that to you. I sent the draft of the book to Bill McKibben. Some of you might know Bill McKibben, an environmental author, and he teaches Sunday school in a little Methodist church in Adirondacks, and is a really, really good writer, one of the leaders in the movement, really, in the environmental field. And he, 4 days later, I got this meditation, this forward back, in the mail. And I felt like he had captured the ethos of the book in one page, right here, of all these different topics and stuff. So I want to read that to you, partly because it's a real invitation to freedom, I think, in the context of a difficult story. It's the story of what I think is a challenging story to us today, is the story of the rich young ruler. So let's have a moment of silence, and then we'll go into that, and then to the discussion of good life and the abundant life.
Thank you for the gift of a new day and what a beautiful day it's been. And pray for your presence with us. So you all know the story probably, most of you. There's this rich young fellow who comes up to Jesus, and the question is, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus responds saying, well, you know the commandments. Obey your mom and dad, and don't kill anybody, and you know, the usual list. And the guy says, good deal. I've done that since I was a young man, a young boy, whatever. And so he's feeling pretty, maybe I'm scot-free here. And then Jesus says, well, one thing you lack, go sell all you have, give it to the poor, and then come and follow me. And at this, the young man goes away sorrowfully, is what the gospel says, and we don't hear from him again. So McKibben is reflecting on this story. As a young man, I came across the gospel account of the rich young man who was told by Christ to give away all his goods. The story hit me like a ton of bricks. It was my first intimation that the Bible was really for me, that simply abstaining from murder and adultery and high-grade lying was not all that a good life required. And the story hit me like a ton of bricks because it seemed so hard. Jesus never seemed sterner. The young man went away sorrowfully, and so, in a sense, did I. This is McKibben writing. But the story has never stopped haunting me, and as I've grown older, I've seen that it involves much more than a moral diktat. For one thing, in my work as an environmentalist, I've come to understand the kind of burden our accumulation places on the planet. And I think we're fairly familiar with that. In a way, thankfully, we're much more aware now than we were 10 years ago of what power the good life or this pursuit of accumulation of stuff impacts the planet. But much more fundamentally, and McKibben goes on, I've come to understand the kind of burden it places on our lives. So here I think McKibben is pointing at sort of the spiritual side of accumulation, the spiritual side of giving ourselves up to the pursuit of false idols. And we'll get into that more later. McKibben goes on, I once wrote an odd book on television which involved watching everything that came across the world's largest cable system on a single day. We spent a year watching, I had tons of friends video this stuff. You watch over a year, you spent watching this one channel cable system. If you boil it all down into one idea, the archetypal idea of the consumer society that we are born into, it would be you and you and you and you are the heaviest known object in the universe, the most important thing on earth. There's no message possible that runs more nearly counter to the message of Jesus. The idea that in losing ourselves, we find ourselves. The idea that in caring for the least around us, we make ourselves whole and real. So seen in that way, Christ's admonition to the rich young man is less a stern commandment than a piece of loving advice. The young man went away sorrowfully, and we don't hear from him again. But perhaps as he aged, he began to understand more fully the wisdom he had heard from Jesus in that brief encounter. And perhaps he began to rearrange his life, to cut down the dense shrubbery of wealth and privilege that kept him from contact with the world, with God, and with his own soul. And then, in the way that Mark tells the story, the young man's repeated questions bring out a kind of gentleness in Christ. If you remember Mark's story, there's a little pause almost after Jesus looks at the young man and loves him, is what it says, and then says, you know, give all you can away, give it away, and then come follow me. So in a sense, it's Christ looking at this man or looking at each of us, and what is it that he might say to us to invite us to this greater freedom so that we can more fully follow Christ? And that's a very poignant question for all of us. And it's risky. But And when we talk about time a little bit later tonight, maybe we'll talk about ways, why that's scary, but also, and also ways we can maybe open ourselves up to begin to hear that answer more, whatever it might be. Seems that in that moment, Christ loved this young man enough that he didn't trim his message, essentially. So, Ellis McKibben's words on the foreword to this book. Any comments on that? Then when I was thinking about how to introduce the book, again, all these different topics and themes, what might be helpful sort of framework for hanging a lot of the issues on. And it seemed to me for Christian faith anyway, folks of Christian faith, that there's this knowledge, this familiarity with the words abundant life. Jesus says, "I've come that you might have life and life abundantly." And so there's that phrase out there that we're sort of familiar with, that's used in a lot of different contexts, really. And then we're also, our culture in general is probably pretty familiar with the phrase, the good life. And so, I'm not a very organized writer, so as I was writing all this stuff, and Jim came back to my executive director and said, "It seems like you're trying to write about the good life and the abundant life." I said, "Okay, that sounds like a good theme." Thank God for good editors. So we've got good life and abundant life as maybe, you know, how would, as groups or individuals go through this book, where and how would you hang the ideas and your interactions with them? Does it seem to embody the good life or the abundant life for you, and so on? So that was the idea in introducing this book, to introduce those two themes that would be familiar to most of us. And just briefly here, the abundant life, the model is this invitation to freedom, and the model in the person is the person of Jesus, the invitation that Christ gives to each of us to freedom, to wholeness. And also, you know, how is it that Jesus encouraged us to live? And then over here, the model is, let's say, TV and media, and essentially, you know, what you get in our culture in terms of being told what's important to pursue. And in some cases, it could be the church, you know, your school. Certainly more things than simply the media push a certain way of living in our culture. So, and what I'd like you to do is just on your own for a minute, and if you have something to write with and on, you can write it down. What part of the pursuit of the good life do you find especially enticing? And if not enticing, if there's no part of the good life, as you understand it, sort of, you know, what our culture tells us we should be about, if not enticing, what's especially difficult to combat? Like, let's say there's certain messages you're getting that they're not enticing, but they're particularly powerful over you, maybe. Particularly powerful and difficult to say, no, that's not... that's not my value. I don't want to do that, but it's difficult to combat. So just take a moment on your own to think and write if you can. I'll write up here. Pursuit of good life is especially enticing, or else, if not enticing, is especially difficult to counteract.
When you say enticing, do you mean if we got some ambition or some pleasure that we like?
Well,
is that what you mean?
I'll give you an example. I think for me, one of the things that just helped me to come back is because of all the images of the good life, the in movies or in TV or the way I'm told to what it means to be success in this culture. And therefore, it almost feels like I'm entitled to that. I begin to compare myself. I think it's very psychological. I begin to compare myself to that image of success. And if I'm not meeting it, I feel resentful or begin to think I'm due it, that it's my right to have that life. And as opposed to, well, so that would be an example of one thing I find particularly difficult to continually come back and say, no, that's not actually my value here. Does anyone else have an example?
Well, the one that comes to me all the time is the idea of you're supposed to enjoy life. You're supposed to have fun. And so, and that's a hard thing because I feel like I'm always doing something that has to be done. And I'd like to have some time to have fun.
So you're supposed to have fun.
Yeah.
And
but there's so many things to do yet.
To get there.
Well, so not that, to get there. There's so many things in the way of having fun.
What are the things in the way? Are those things that the culture is telling you to do? Or that?
Well, to some degree. You're supposed to do your work at church.
Okay.
You know. You're supposed to help your neighbor. You're supposed to help your family. And we have an extended family, you know. And so it's that type of thing.
Okay. Now, is this image, though, that's supposed to have fun, is that a positive for you?
I can't say that.
Because there's also this pressure to, like...
It's enticing.
You're supposed to be happy all the time.
Yeah. It's very enticing.
So I had another hand up back there first, and then going... another thing that
maybe
might be
connected to that, sort of the flip side, is spending a lot of time and energy to be quote successful, just feeling that I'm putting way too much energy and time into meeting this image of success, mm-hmm. and therefore not having that fun for doing other things.
Just a quick response to the... I know this couple, they have three young kids, and their house is an absolute disaster area, but they enjoy their children because they decide that they don't have to have a house that looks like it comes out of Better Home and Gardens in order to be good parents. That being good parents is about loving and being with their children, so dishes are always piled up in the sink. But the thing that's the enticing thing to me is about new things. But I have to have new things. I have to have a new car, new clothes, new TV, new computer. And I have to always get new things. And it's especially deceiving because people will say, well, you can always give your old stuff to Goodwill.
Yeah,
which is like a politically correct excuse to go buy a new TV. The old one works just fine.
Yeah. And I'll give you my address, you can just drop by. Local Goodwill store.
It's just more consumerism.
Yeah, right. And it also, it requires more production and resources and so on. And even giving things to Goodwill requires you to buy something else that came from here eventually. Yeah, go ahead.
One thing I find very enticing, I think because of my stage of life, is the idea of pursuing security.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has to do with saving for college or buying life insurance, or, and it can come in so many guises, it's incredible.
Yeah.
But that's a big problem.
That's a problem.
That's a very problem.
There are a lot of people sitting in.
I think the one enticement is the freedom, unrestricted travel.
You know?
Wherever we want to go, we should be able to climb in our car and go there, or train, or bus, or plane.
Mine was similar to that, in that I put this invitation to freedom for abundant life, and I thought, no, that really belongs in the car. That somehow, either. That if I had more money or whatever things are, I'd have somehow, you know, things are more convenient, so I have more time on my hands to go have fun, to travel. Particularly for me, for traveling, I don't know, that it's somehow, the good life means more freedom by, you know, certain conveniences or a certain standard of income or whatnot that allows me to have that freedom.
Right.
I think just piggybacking on that too, for me it's like just this idea of should be entitled to have the convenience of getting in your single occupancy vehicle to go wherever you want, as opposed to having to think and plan enough that you might, at least on a couple of days, take the bus and figure out when your meetings are, so that you don't have to have, you know, so that you could cut back on that, knowing how bad it is for the earth to have all of that pollution from cars, and still struggling with not wanting to have the convenience of being able to go to this meeting or structure your life in a way that doesn't have to depend on anything else.
Yeah.
Single occupancy SUV.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I
passed that one up. That's
no SUV.
And kind of like that, I'm really enticed by things that give me back time. And I think for a long time I drove my car because it saved me 20 minutes a day that I could go for something that doesn't work and not on a bus.
The time savers or
anything that gives me time.
Yeah. It
makes me more efficient.
So maybe underneath it is the idol of efficiency for you or not?
I think at this point in my life it's more, not less efficiency and more time. I mean, I'm definitely having time. Efficiency doesn't always get to, but at this point in time.
Okay, well, I'm just showing you some powerful ones. Is there anyone just burning to get another one up there?
There's something about freedom from people who need things from me. It's not only the convenience of things, it's freedom from inconvenient people. They're on the bus. They're in certain neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You mean like they need your attention?
Well, like homeless people.
Yeah.
People in need. Maybe I'm willing to write a check for a charity, but part of this whole good life. I never see that advertised. When you go to Cancun to work in a homeless shelter or something for 2 weeks.
just these beautiful people, and they're all self-contained, and I want to be one of them. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get one more here.
Mm-hmm. Well, mine tied in with the new things. I just sometimes find it very difficult to resist not just new things, but more.
Yeah.
More things. You know, not one computer, two computers. Not one phone, three phones plus a cell phone, you know. And it starts cluttering, you know, it kind of is supposed to free you, but
yeah.
It calls more. Now you get calls when you're on the phone, you know, in the car.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on a hike.
Right.
It does, all these seem to tie in so much, though, is instant gratification. It's, you don't want to wait for to make that phone call. You want to be able to make it from the car right now. And it ties in with so many things. Instant heat and instant water and instant food.
And yeah, it's a lot of convenience, too. Mm-hmm. Sounding on drastic action wasn't working. Okay. So, well, that's, yeah. So does that help you, sir, in terms of the things that we were thinking about? And what would yours be now that we've shared all these? Theories?
Well, I look at some of these things, like he says, having fun. He listed a whole bunch of things. I have done those things and they've been a big enjoyment. It's been, you know.
Yeah.
So a lot of these things, you know, I don't know.
Well, this is not a list of things that are wrong. This is a list of things that we find enticing, some of which are sold as part of the good life. And the question is that true? Or are they part of the abundant life, maybe, some of them? And how do they kind of mimic each other? I think the difficulty here is that, often anyway, that there are ways that the good life and the abundant life come close to one another. I mean, the abundant life that we might say is modeled after Christ, how Christ would have us live, and what the good life offers to us. Are there ways in which there are pretty elements of both that are close, and therefore difficult to tell apart? And I think there's some truth to that. So maybe let's just go there now. As an example, the good life, we've mentioned some things up here like new things or money. There are things that the good life offers us up here that would allow us to take care of those around us, right? So maybe it's saving for college, or if that's one of our goals for helping take care of our children, for example. So the good life offers us, let me screen you a little bit here from that. The good life promises to meet at least basic human material needs, right? And it's done pretty well at that for more and more people, at least in the first world. I mean, our wealth has grown significantly. And certainly it seems like one aspect of the abundant life would be able to take care of those around us or be part of taking care of basic material needs. So there's a similarity, but what's the weakness there? What's left out of the picture? Seems like in the definition of the good life, it does so for only a few at the expense of the many. Or another way to say that is, seems to me that last night I talked to him about circles of care, circles of compassion, and that those included in our circle of compassion, our community, are very limited. Maybe for some people it's just your own self. You know, you make a lot of money and you're damn well proud of it, and you're going to get whatever you want. And or maybe it's your family, or maybe it's your ethnic group or your immediate community. So the community of concern is rather small, and I think it's especially true when we integrate ecological concerns in there. That our community
We are made up of more than ourselves and other people. We are in nature itself as well. We are dependent upon a healthy biotic community for our life as well. So when we begin to expand those for whom we are called to care, the community of compassion, to whom we are called to extend compassion, to include the earth, certainly the good life doesn't include that at all in its concern. In fact, it negates, you know, our economic system doesn't, quote-unquote, value those things from the earth at what they really are worth. So that's an example of, it's difficult because there's a lot of good things there and a lot of good things to offer to those we love. And how do we begin to say, yes, the abundant life, however, would have a larger community as part of that which we're concerned about? And then how would that affect our actions?
Well, I think an extreme of that was on television a couple of years ago was the ad for the lotto. And it showed this really beautiful lake. It was real placid, and they read a couple lines from Thoreau and said, you know, but why settle for this when you could have? And then this big, powerful motorboat just took off across the screen. You know, I mean, it was just glaring in its blatantness. You know, it's like just was making fun of the idea that tranquility or thoughtfulness or reflection or peace could be anything in comparison to this boat and all these toys you could buy if you won the lotto. Yeah. It was shocking, really.
Yeah, it's pretty blatant sometimes. Sort of hard to win.
You know, some of the more extreme things where it's just obvious consumerism or just love of money or things like that, you know, gas-guzzling SUVs and all those things. Those things are so pretty easy for me to avoid. But,
yeah.
For example, I just 6 months ago bought an old house that was run down, a 1917 house. And it's a beautiful house in a great neighborhood, and I want to spend time fixing it up. But my conflict is, why am I going to spend all of my free time for the next year and a half on my house so that it's going to be beautiful and wonderful and lovely for me to have and have guests in when I'm not spending nearly that much time and effort on any larger circle than that? But it feels like a good thing to do because I'm not building a house and I'm not, you know, I'm helping a neighborhood. And that's the kind of gray area where in the overlap for me that I really have a hard time reconciling.
Well, anyone want to respond to that?
I relate.
Yeah.
That's really hard one.
I guess it's difficult, I think, because because it's difficult to separate out, I think, particularly in, I think all these things boil down to separating out need from like, it would be, or need from it would be nice. You know, I don't have any shoes that don't have holes. You know, all my shoes have holes in them. So I probably really need a pair of shoes versus I've got 5 pairs of shoes and none of them have holes in them. So I really need a pair of shoes. But of course, you know, there's this thing saying, well, you've got, you know, this or that, I don't know, skirt or whatever, and so you need a pair of shoes to go with. You know, and I shoes is actually not my weakness, but
Plus, you're not being personal.
And so I think that sort of relates to your case too. Like, do you need to have this beautiful house?
Well,
or do you just need to have a functional house that maybe doesn't require a year and a half of your time? I mean, I mean, obviously, you need shelter, an adequate shelter. I mean, if the roof's leaking, you probably need a new roof. But where do you draw the line between this is necessary and this is just something that would make my life nicer or more convenient or comfortable?
Yeah, that's a... And I don't want to get too much into details of individual lives tonight, but I think it points to the need to have folks in your life to ask that of, you know, and have help in determining that for yourself.
I just bought a house for the first time in my life 3 months ago, and I have some similar, very similar questions. I think simplicity and abundance also has a lot of room for beauty and hospitality. And that's one of the things I found in having a house is being able to offer hospitality and live in a place that is beautiful. Now, of course, there's questions. There's plenty of people who don't have that opportunity, and I live with that tension. And we all do in this culture. And I don't want to get into sort of a list of do's and don'ts, because remember, the framework is this Jesus looking at us and in love. You know, what else? What do I need to do or to be saved? You know, let's keep going back to asking Jesus to, or God to help us with that question. So that's my sort of broader response, so that we don't get caught up in too specific, you know, what should I do about buying this thing or that thing. But it's a very poignant question. And I think it becomes a very spiritual question, these whole things, all those things, because, for example, if we look at how do we define our sense of self-worth under these two ways of looking at the world, the abundant life, in a Christian context, would be our sense of self-worth is based on our being made in God's image and being, by the grace of God, we are who we are, right? Saved by grace through faith. So there's this sense of freedom. As opposed to the good life, often we get caught up in needing to define ourselves by our possessions, by our positions of power, or by our abilities. And for those of you who were here Monday night, we talked about this call to conversion, story of the temptations of Christ, and that three temptations that Christ faced were indeed to prove himself. You know, the tempter says to Christ, if you're the Son of God, thereby questioning his very self-definition. So if you are the Son of God, then do these things. And the things that Christ was tempted to do were prove himself by his abilities, prove yourself by your abilities, by your possessions. You know, if Jesus would have bowed down to the devil, he would have given the kingdom, all the kingdoms of the world. So that's pretty precious stuff, and it's also a pretty powerful position. So possessions and positions of power. And then over here, again, our sense of worth is based on God's grace and identity resting in God. Did I put your hand up from there? Did you want
to? I was just struck by, for me, it seems like the important piece is the invitations of freedom. So, you know, this dilemma that you're in, for example, it seems like I would have to ask myself pretty regularly if the choices I was making were in response to that invitation, if the choices were leading towards freedom, because I think the good life continues to entrap us.
Mm-hmm.
And the results don't lead to greater freedom, they lead to wanting more, or needing more, needing to shore it up somehow.
Yeah, thanks. That reminds me of the word idol. And we've talked some about idols in this
during this week, Economic Growth being a powerful one. And we kind of identified some of them here. I mean, convenience or efficiency can even become an idol in this culture. But maybe the good life is a broader arching one here, which a lot of these fit. And an idol, I think it's very helpful for me to think about an idol as promising something that it cannot finally deliver. So, you know, you achieve this, you have this idol or whatever, and it doesn't deliver on its promise. An idol promises something that it cannot finally deliver. Or some folks, I think, find it helpful to think of it, a lesser good elevated to the ultimate good. Because, again, we've been identifying some things that are good about the good life. When they become elevated to our sort of God, they become an idol. And your comment about this, how they keep entrapping us, this pursuit, points to how powerful an idol is in a way, and how well our culture has kept us pursuing those things because it's such a powerful idol. Yes, go ahead.
And one thing that I find that I have to keep reminding myself of is that those messages are so pervasive, and there's hardly any alternative voice ever presented. Mm-hmm. And you know, even in terms of what products are in the grocery store, if I just go to a different store, I go, oh, I can buy this instead. I didn't even know that existed, you know. But just that those messages of, you know, what cars do you see advertised on television, for example? You don't see every different kind of car advertised on television. You only see the ones that they want to buy. And so to keep myself connected to other non-mainstream alternatives to what's available, even, you know, types of paint and anything.
Yeah. And it's hard to, sometimes it's real hard to find the information too. You have to spend some time figuring out where to find the alternatives.
It's a form of brain, the media is like is a form of brainwashing. I don't know how intentional or I don't think it's really a conspiracy. I think they're just doing the best they can to try and sell their stuff. But what it turns into is that we're given this very two-dimensional set of choices that.
How much millions of dollars are spent on advertising a year? Do you know the figure?
Just Mo and Mem. It's in here somewhere.
Well, just to get back, that it's hard to fight that. I mean, it's hard to fight. You know, we are studied. There are breakout groups on what makes us salivate over whatever. You know, hair, makeup, blah blah, diet plans, you know, whatever, and it's, you know, there's billions spent for us to want it, and sometimes it's just hard to not buy in a little bit.
Oh yeah, I think there's $2,200 per person.
What's that?
That was in the book. $2,200 per person
per year.
Per year.
Oh my God.
When you compare that to the gross national product, like in Nicaragua, it's $210 per person.
Spending
10 times
that just on advertising.
Oh my God, the other thing.
Let's see, we had his hand up earlier, so I want to.
Just in this tension between the good life and the abundant life, the thing you know, Lori brought up, you know, pursuing security is an issue. One of the things that I sort of think about is my kids' education and sort of providing for that. And that tension between the good life and the abundant life, some of that is resolved if you can sort of clear the way to some kind of acceptance of what is. And that is that you can't send all of your, every, all, you know, but there are limits. If they can't go to Harvard, perhaps, you know, and maybe a state education is what is there, or maybe it's, you know, there's limits, the acceptance of limits. It has good enough. I mean, it has, you know, that the title or the pinnacle is not always attainable.
And I think the message of the good life is that there are no limits. They're not really entitled.
You never make it with the good life. There's always something missing. You don't have quite enough with the abundance, the acceptance of limits you feel.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, the advertising is to entice us to consume, and
one of the messages that I hear, if you listen between the lines, by being consumers and consuming, you're actually doing a very patriotic thing. In fact, what George Bush wants us all to do with our tax rebate is go out and spend it.
Right.
By spending it, we let other people get some of the good life because that provides jobs. And, you know, what would happen if all of a sudden everybody started doing like a, you know, not participating in this, then that would mean that, you know, for at least a short or some period of time, all these people whose jobs depend upon us consuming are not going to have any jobs, too. And, you know, it's a really complex problem.
It's not only, it's also, you're right, there's an appeal to patriotism, but there's also some truth in what you're saying about how our system is set up to thrive on continual consumption, and that would be good news if we continually did that.
Mm-hmm.
And
sort of.
Go ahead, then. And then I want to move on to another issue before it's almost time to go.
Personally, for me, I've made a transition in my life. TV is out, period. And I've noticed that I don't have as much consumerism anymore. I don't get the local paper. I mean, I don't tune out from society, but that consumerism driving me is really diminished a great deal. Now, of course, you could have a TV, but watch it very judiciously and just watch public television or something. But I think, you know, a good part of my consumerism was based on TV watching.
We only have about 10 more minutes, so I want to move into a comparison of the sense of time in these two ways of life. It's not only very practical, I think it's very fundamental as well, and touches on our own spirituality. So I think it's a good thing to spend a little time with, so to speak. And you notice most of my words around time, I'm saying spend time. We spend time and we use time. And so what does that indicate? Where time is money, what does that indicate about our sense of what time is?
Work.
What's that?
Work.
The commodity. Right? The commodity. And it's very limited. And you better use it well. And what's that? As opposed, I mean, it seems to me, actually, time, what is time really but the gift of life? And we all have a certain, we've been blessed so far, each of us with a certain amount of a gift of having life. We don't know how long that will be. The New Roadmap Foundation talks about time. They're the people that put out Your Money or Your Life, that book. Time is the gift of life energy. The gift of life energy. So, again, a recognition of giftedness there. And so it seems to move us toward a sense of time as being a gift. And life itself, if we feel life itself is a sacred gift from God, then time becomes a sacred gift. To be lived and experienced, not spent. And that's a really tough one to combat, as we all know. It's one of the tougher ones. But let's just say a sense of sacred gift, because it's essentially our life. And to say that time is money eventually seems to me commodifies all of life. Now, there's a couple essays in the book around this issue. One sort of more addressing time as commodity, another encouraging a sense of time as sacred, or how might that be evoked, how do we experience that? And one of the essays I found particularly helpful in there is one by Gerald May. I want to read to you briefly from that essay. But first, when time becomes a commodity, one of the things I think that becomes an idol within that is quote-unquote productivity. I think efficiency gets tied in with that as well. So I want to read a little bit about productivity and then move to reading a bit from Gerald May for a bit of a different perspective and invitation. And of course, within each idol, if productivity is an idol, there's some good within it because it's a lesser good elevated to the ultimate good. So there's certainly nothing wrong with productivity or efficiency, and the sense of accomplishment from a job well done is worth celebrating. And I wonder if the good within it is like offering one's gifts back to one's community, you know, fully utilizing our gifts and making a genuine contribution. But in our driven busyness, it seems the real danger to me is that we don't take time to listen anymore. We no longer know who we are. It seems often, and this still small voice is lost in this cacophony of voices urging us on to the next task. Lacking the ability, or losing it, to listen and follow God's voice in our own inner direction, we become increasingly susceptible to the marking of the good life. You know, it's interesting, the more and more busy, the more and more tied up in pursuits, the more and more susceptible we are to, and when we find those pursuits not fulfilling, the more susceptible we are to the marketing of the good life, because that marketing is going to tell you, well, you're doing pretty well, but you just need this next thing to fulfill you. And so that's what I mean when it seems to me we get caught on that treadmill where we can't listen anymore, and the still small voice is lost in this cacophony of voices saying, do the next thing or buy the next thing. Why is it that that's such a difficult thing for us to change in life is a question I've had. Well, in other words, why is it difficult maybe to slow down for a moment and listen, let's say. And Gerald May has a very helpful comment on that when he says, it's a book called The Awakened Heart, and there's a chapter in there called Entering the Emptiness. And he says that when we do slow down or attempt to listen, or you could think of a variety of ways, meditate, say no to doing something some evening, and be. He suggests that we often experience some form of emptiness inside. Do you have experiences of that?
Yes.
Some of you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to fill them? Is that what he's saying?
Exactly. And we're fearful of the reality of our emptiness at some level. And yet he says it's our emptiness that is our greatest hope. Because he believes it's our emptiness that draws us to God, that it's actually the yearning for God within us being expressed, and that therefore to lose our emptiness is to lose our greatest hope, because it's that place out of which we continually seek God. Now I see some people nodding and some people saying this is wacko. So I'm wondering if someone would like to comment on either one of those sides of it.
I guess to me I believe there's a God-sized void in each of us, and if we don't have God in it, we stuff it full of whatever else we can find to fill it, be that alcohol, drugs, possessions, whatever. And maybe that's part of what he's talking about, saying that if you don't allow that void to be there, there's no room for God.
Mm-hmm.
So if you fill it up with possessions, then God's sort of left out. And so the emptiness doesn't exist for God to come in.
Dan, when we were hiking, you had a good comment too, I thought about it. You want to, or just whatever you were going to say, you had your hand up too. So, because we talked about this a bit in our silent hike. And that was tough. We had some good thoughts.
I was just thinking that I think this goes to the heart of the biblical insight as well, that what I recalled on that hike was that in the letter to the Philippians that Paul wrote, he quotes a hymn that scholars think is the oldest existing bit of Christian writing, because he's quoting a hymn that was already being sung 15 years after Jesus. And it's about how the Greek word is kenosis, that the self-emptying is what is, when we empty ourselves of all the stuff, or the desire for stuff, which the Bible refers to as flesh, the desires of the flesh, then there's room for God to come in. And that Philippians quote is that because Jesus emptied himself, even of his divinity, God raised him up to being one with God. But that it was through that self-emptying. And so when we do spiritual practice to empty ourselves, it seems like we're on that biblical route. And what idols are anything to try to fill that. And when you were talking earlier about that, I was thinking that the Hebrew word Satan is deceiver, the deceiver with a capital D, and that's the source of, in our baptismal liturgy, when the parents are asked, do you renounce Satan and all of his empty promises? This step is another version of the empty promise, that anything can fill that.
Yeah.
Our hearts, except God, or the Spirit, or the things that are free.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I think I'm just personally, one of the things that opens me up to my own emptiness is some of what I talked about in the service yesterday, and that is the pain of other people and places. Either working with homeless men, the pain of wolves being shot out of, herded and shot out of airplanes. It seems to me that openness to pain also, and the relationships that we do have, this connectedness that we do have with one another, whether we realize it or not, opens us up also to joy. And that is a cycle almost of being emptied and filled, emptied and filled. And that is that cycle, and the emptiness that we get in touch with sometimes, at least I get in touch with when I realize sort of my own need, let's say, my own sense of being lost and separate from others or from this earth, is what called me to ask to be filled again. And that's a continual process for me. Anyone else have something you want to say about that, or just makes no sense anymore? Because I think it's a pretty important
I'm sort of confused. I mean, to be quite honest, I guess I feel quite full, if this makes any sense, that I, the things that make me feel full, and it's funny because I've been I wrote this just in my journal yesterday about rethinking. I'm not a Christian, and rethinking, though, I think that there's a lot in the Bible that offers a personal ethic, but I'm not comfortable with a lot of the metaphors used in the Bible and the Christian metaphor for God, to be honest. And I've been spending a lot of time thinking about what sort of metaphor would I replace this with.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that of things that make me feel full, and I think of some beautiful pieces of art, like Rembrandt's Lucretia, of her and these huge eyes and tears, in my hike yesterday, and when it was raining, and watching these clouds on the mountains, and getting silly drunk on a couple of bottles of wine with my housemates over a great dinner. I mean, those things make me feel full, and that these are important. These are to me what are important somehow. And so I'm really confused about this emptiness.
But all the things you listed are certainly not things that are being sold.
So where's this emptiness coming from? Like, I mean, I guess the way you're describing it is what is this emptiness caused by? You know, why do you feel empty sometimes? Like, what things? Like, I honestly don't understand.
Have you never had the experience of emptiness? Of sort of...
I can't think of anything recently, no.
could be an age-related phenomenon.
Dan's suggesting loneliness, lack of maybe lack of connection. What were you saying?
It could be an age-related phenomenon. I mean, she seems pretty young to me, and maybe the older you get, there that emptiness starts to form when your friends break away. And
perhaps, although I think I've certainly felt emptiness as a pretty young person.
Never.
Yeah, and I do think there are certain personality types that are more susceptible to being in touch with that, perhaps. Dan, you said loneliness. I'm wondering if you have other words that you find.
Yeah, because I guess maybe I'm having trouble with the word emptiness as far as what do you mean by this? What does empty mean? It's a word we use that sounds nice, but what does it really mean?
Newsweek did a huge article on are you in your 20s?
Mm-hmm.
Your generation feeling unconnected to anybody. And the whole thing was that people in their 20s, and I'm just saying this is what Newsweek's article said, aren't connected. They don't feel connected to people. They don't feel connected to churches. They don't feel connected to community. And that is a huge missing part of people's lives.
And the things you were talking about, though, that fill you up are being connected. They're not things that are being sold to you by the good life.
That's right.
They're things available to all of us. That's one thing. Think that you were describing things that are part of abundance. The bell rang. So let's just. It's a very good question, because I do think that and how to describe it so that all of us can sort of. Something you think about, so emptiness means nothing to you.
I would say that a large part of moving from, let's say, a good life to abundant life is going to be self-awareness and being able to really kind of realize what one of these you're actually going at or is, way that is to realize what it is, if loneliness is emptiness or whatever that, what this is associated with, and that you can recognize it. And sometimes you have to have words.
Maybe you're just healthy.
Exactly. maybe you're just really healthy.
and very self-aware. And many of us need to be, one of the ways to be more self-aware, it seems to me, is to be able to slow down and be quiet for a moment. And that's one of the things that's not encouraged in this good life stuff, to slow down and be quiet. So let us go now in peace. Love and serve the Lord. Let's go, and thanks for coming.
Thank you
so much.
But I've noticed that some lights have been in here.
I think I felt that more since I knew God.
I don't think I would feel it very often.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very
often.
I
don't
think
you'll
see
people
here.
We read A Student a Day. By Dorothy Duff. It's a great book about God's
Yet.
He said that? Basically, A Student a Day, Dorothy Duff.
Yeah. Basically?
You know how many times I've had trips like this?
You are very wise.
Cool.
Berkeley.
I haven't heard of it even.
I'm so wise.
Yeah.